Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Get ready for a summer of politics. Actually, we'll get you ready this hour with a look at politics at all levels, and we begin right here in Charlotte, where last night Charlotte City Council voted on a controversial noise ordinance, and it was noisy at the council meeting last night, too.
We refuse to be silenced by the City of Charlotte capitalism and useless ordinances. Women of the working class, we will stand to be harassed.
WFAE's Sarah D'Elia was at that meeting where citizens had their final say before council voted. She has the final results of that vote and what we call a scene setter to fill us in on the atmosphere that led to the vote last night. Welcome to the program. Welcome back.
Thanks, Mike.
How many people were we listening to there?
Well, that was a group of protesters that as soon as the council sat down at the dais, immediately charged the dais and hopped up. So I was actually sitting next to a couple of them, and they ran up the dais and unraveled this kind of large flag that they had made. And they were very vocal. They sounded very loud, but there was actually only five or six of them. And okay. I believe three of them actually got arrested.
Really? All right. So yesterday we did a whole hour on this and why this ordinance, this noise ordinance, is so controversial. But for people who were not listening and don't follow this, fill us in on the details.
So the big controversy comes down to an abortion clinic that's located on Latrobe Drive in East Charlotte. And it is heavily protested by people who are anti-abortion activists. And they believe that they are sending their message through amplified sound to men and women who are entering this clinic, trying to dissuade them from choosing abortion as a choice of, a medical procedure, and trying to get them to think of another choice and to come and use their services. So you have groups like Cities for Life, Love Life Charlotte, who are very vocal, who are out there regularly week to week, saying that this is how they exercise their First Amendment right, through amplified sound that's pointed at the direction of the clinic, that's pointed at these people that are accessing healthcare this
way. But this noise ordinance doesn't just deal with Latrobe Drive. Right. It deals with the garbage pickup, it deals with construction noise, it deals with buskers on the street uptown Charlotte. And Julie Eiselt, the mayor pro tem and a Democrat at large councilperson, was on the program yesterday saying that she has received, and I had the emails yesterday, she has received countless emails from people around the Park Road Shopping Center and other shopping centers and downtown complaining about the noise, which justifies this noise ordinance. And then Ed Driggs was also on the program yesterday. He's a Republican in District 7. And he said this is just a way to target these people on Latrobe Drive and their free speech rights. That I'm sure that all came out last night.
That definitely did. I mean, the majority of the people that you're absolutely right. The ordinance does deal with other things besides what's going on Latrobe Drive. Absolutely. But the majority of the people that signed up to speak were either in there of support of protesting and amplified sound outside of Latrobe Drive, or they were associated with the clinic that were saying this is disruptive behavior and it's damaging to patients.
How many people did speak last night?
Oh, gosh. Well, before we sat down, the list was 108 people. But then at the last minute, a bunch of other folks signed up. So I think the total list was like 125. There were, a handful of people that didn't stick around to the end, but the list was about 125.
How long did they have to speak?
They had a minute. Okay. Usually there's, I believe it's 2 minutes. So it was 1 minute last night.
So let's hear half of what anti-abortion activist Daniel Parks had to say about why he opposed the changes to this ordinance.
Abortion will come to an end in our nation, but as long as it remains a scourge in our city, God's people will stand against it in prayer and outreach. Over the past few years, the city of Charlotte has attacked every form of speech that we use to protect these precious babies, from literally snatching life-saving signs out of the hands of pro-life volunteers, to trying to stop us from parking the ultrasound RV near the abortion clinics, to pressuring CMPD to write citations for offering literature to women seeking abortions, and now trying to suppress our message by changing the sound ordinance.
How much of that is true? The city of Charlotte, he said, snatched signs from abortion protesters' hands.
I know that there are a couple of lawsuits that are pending, and there are some past lawsuits that are about that issue, about size of signs, about people grabbing signs. I can't really talk about the details of those lawsuits, but there's a history of this.
And it is true that they tried to pass a parking ordinance. Maybe they did. I can't remember on Latrobe Drive because it's not that big a street. It's not a great big wide street, and it's kind of, if I recall correctly, it's kind of a horseshoe on which there are other businesses.
Yes.
Other than just this a preferred women's health clinic, which is where they protest on almost a daily basis. On the other side of the coin, there was Kelsey McLean, who spoke to council about why she supports the changes to the ordinance. Let's hear half of what she had to say.
The reality is I had an abortion in 2010, and there were protesters in front of my clinic. They weren't allowed to use amplification, yet somehow I was able to figure out their message, what they wanted to say, and that they were hostile to my choice when I walked in. There was no need for amplification for me to understand their message. Their freedom of speech was heard loud and clear. What we are hoping for is the passing of common sense rules that will make sure that sound level cannot reach inside the facility where healthcare is taking place.
How many people were there speaking in favor of? How many people were there speaking against this noise ordinance?
I mean, I have to say that the anti-abortion group Love Life Charlotte, they were there. They packed the house, and overwhelmingly, they were the speakers. I mean, I would say it was probably like 70-30 of Love Life versus people that were in support of the ordinance.
Julie Iselt has said that a lot of the people who are opposed to this noise ordinance are from out of town, and they come because they support fellow believers in the right to life. How many were from out of town last night?
So apparently Julie Iselt was doing some math as each speaker was coming up, and she said at the end of the meeting in her closing remarks that 61% of the speakers that came to oppose the noise ordinance were not from Charlotte. And that was, you know, we heard a lot of people coming, speakers were asked to say where they were from and their first and last name, heard a lot of Matthews, Concord, those areas.
We did a lot of talking yesterday on this program with Ed Driggs and Julie Iselt and Patrick Baker, who was the city attorney, about the buffer zone that was initially suggested by the proposal, which was 200 feet. They decided last night to reduce that buffer. And Ed Driggs was saying at 200 feet it was too far. It was too far away. But 200 feet is a little over half of a football field. With amplification, that you could clearly hear anybody at 200 feet. Why did they reduce it to 150?
I asked Julie Iselt that question, and she said that this was more in line with what other cities have passed in their ordinances, that the 150 is what is been seen in other cities. So that's ultimately why they went with it, she thinks.
So the vote was?
It was 8-3.
In favor of the ordinance?
Yes.
8-3, that means that there are two Republicans on council, Ed Driggs and Tariq Bakari. Mm-hmm. It was a foregone conclusion that they would vote against because Ed Driggs was on this program to say why he opposed it yesterday. And this is what he said about why he still opposed it last night.
I believe the city is trying to circumvent the controversy by burying the medical facility quiet zone in a broad-based ordinance update and acting as if it's only about sound.
And the other person who voted against it was a Democrat, Greg Phipps. Did he give a reason why he voted against the rest of the Democrats on this?
He had some questions. He didn't give an explicit reason, but it seemed like he had some questions and wasn't fully convinced that this was going to solve the changes to the ordinance weren't going to solve anything.
Right. So. The abortion issue is tied up in a lot of different things, among them religion. And at last night's meeting, Mayor Pro Tem Julie Iselt tried to assure the crowd her vote and this ordinance was not about religion.
We're not here to regulate religion. We're not here to regulate morality. We're here to keep the peace in the city and to assure quality of life in a city that's growing very quickly.
So this will go into effect not just on Latrobe Drive, but everywhere. One of the problems with the current ordinance is that people say it is subjective and sporadically enforced. Are there things in this noise ordinance that make it easy for police to say when they respond to a noise complaint that you're definitely violating this and you will stop now or here's the fine?
Well, I think this buffer zone and the 150 feet, that's going to be the interesting thing to see how the police respond to that. People, I think, can be, well, I should add that people in the 150 feet, they can be there and they can hand out their literature. They can talk to people. It's just that they can't have amplified sound within that 150 feet from a place like the clinic. So it's going to be interesting to see if this is helpful to the police in interpreting the law. We heard from some experts that had been consulted as the council had sort of drafted this ordinance, these proposed changes, and they said that they found in other cities where this buffer zone was put in place that they did see a reduction in 911 calls, mm-hmm. and that it did seem like an easier way to be able to police.
So this will still go into effect in October, right? Is that correct?
I believe so.
And Patrick Baker, the city attorney, says it's likely to end up in court. Will any court appearance prior to October delay its implementation, or will it just simply stop it later on if the court decides in a different direction?
That's a good question. I'm not quite sure of the answer. I will say, though, that people did bring up potential lawsuits and bringing it to court as they were speaking last night.
WFAE Sarah D'Elia, thank you for joining us. Late night last night, I'm sure. So go take a nap.
Thanks, Mike.
As I said, it's going to be a summer of politics, not just here in Charlotte, but in Raleigh, Washington, and around the country. In Raleigh, the final budget has yet to be finalized as lawmakers wrangle over details of pay raises and Medicaid expansion. That's also where a confrontation between lawmakers and law enforcers has been fulminating. The 9th District Congressional race is underway and heading toward the voters in September. All eyes are on the Supreme Court as we wait to hear a decision, or if there will be one, in North Carolina's political gerrymandering case, and the Democratic presidential debates begin this week. Lots to talk about for the rest of the hour with Dr. Michael Bitzer, professor of politics and history at Catawba College. Welcome back.
Good to be here.
Dr. Susan Roberts is here, professor of political science at Davidson College. Thanks. You for joining us.
Good to see you.
And Steve Harrison has replaced Sarah D'Elia in the hot seat, the WFAE hot seat from WFAE News. He is our political reporter.
Hey, Mike.
We thought that the Supreme Court would announce their decision on political gerrymandering on Friday. They didn't. We waited again yesterday. They didn't. Nothing. Now we're waiting to see if they'll issue their ruling by the end of the week. Remind us, Dr. Bitzer, what are they considering?
They are considering whether partisan gerrymandering is constitutional or not. And what has happened is, out of North Carolina, a case has come that a 3-judge panel said partisan gerrymandering is unconstitutional because it violates things like the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause, the First Amendment's freedom of speech, and Article 1 of the Constitution about the U.S. House and its elections. And this would be a pretty monumental decision if the court chooses to uphold the principle of you can go too far in partisan gerrymandering, because in the past, the court has been very hesitant to enter into what is called a political question. These are issues that are best resolved by a legislature or the executive. The courts want to stay out. There is an opportunity for the court to insert itself. The question is, are they willing to do so?
There are two political gerrymandering cases on the docket.
Right.
One's from Maryland. The one in North Carolina is called Bob Ruscio versus Common Cause. And the Maryland case is it Lamone versus Benisek?
Yes.
What's the difference?
The difference is that Republicans were advantaged in North Carolina based on the congressional districts, and Democrats were advantaged in the Maryland congressional district.
And this is the second time for both of these to be considered. The Maryland case was before the court before, and they sent it back?
They sent it back because of issues of standing, whether the persons, the individuals bringing the lawsuit had justification to bring those lawsuits.
And the same is true for North Carolina. They sent
that
back to the lower courts. Why is it back?
It's back now. They think that the standing issue has been resolved, and so now they can get to the merits of the case, whether partisan gerrymandering is indeed unconstitutional.
So we'll come back and talk more about the case and the whole process of how these decisions are handled and how they are handed down and why they are just drip, drip, drip out for weeks on end. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking politics for the remainder of the hour here, there, and everywhere. Dr. Michael Bitzer is here from Catawba College, Dr. Susan Roberts from Davidson College, and Steve Harrison from WFAE News. He's our political reporter. There are these two cases, the Supreme Court cases that we've been talking about, the North Carolina political gerrymandering case, the one in Maryland as well. Would a decision on one, we don't know what the decisions on either are because they haven't come down yet,
correct,
but would a decision on one impact the other? Do they have to make decisions on both? In other words, if they decide one way in Maryland, does that decide for North Carolina and vice versa?
I think that's where we are. We just don't know. The court can go in any direction it chooses. We've got a sense when Justice Kennedy was on the court that he would welcome entries into striking down partisan gerrymandering, but that was a case out of Pennsylvania several years ago. What we're dealing with now is the court needs to come up with some kind of standard by which, A, they can say this is too much partisan gerrymandering or it's not, and then B, say, well, here's how you will resolve if it's too much partisan gerrymandering, and that's part of the problem. It's just like with racial gerrymandering. They never said, you have to draw maps that are exactly like this.
Right.
They kind of gave wiggle room and they would say, well, yeah, we think that this is too much racial gerrymandering, but this is okay. It's just all over the place.
Steve.
I was just going to say that during arguments in March before the court, there are two plaintiffs in the case, Common Cause and the League of Women Voters. They took kind of different approaches. Common Cause, their view was that any map that's drawn in any way to give one advantage over one party over another is unconstitutional. Yeah. And then the League of Women Voters kind of, they took a different approach and they said, no, that is going to happen. That's impossible to take out. They just wanted the court to police the most extreme cases. So even on the plaintiff's side, there is not agreement as to where do you draw the line.
So with regard, I don't know what the Maryland case is about, but I know what, I know it's Democrats.
Democrats drew a district advantage them.
In North Carolina, it's fairly blatant because the legislature, one person in the legislature came out and said, we did this to lock the Democrats out. We did it this way because we couldn't make it any worse.
Right.
We tried.
David Lewis, who chaired the redistricting committee, said, I drew the map 10-3 because I couldn't draw 11-2.
Right. So given that, does that give fuel to the fire? Does it give bullets to the Supreme Court to fire?
Well, I think that it's now or never. And I think with a more conservative court, I think people are looking to see this as a guideline. And as Michael said, the courts have always said it's a political thicket in one of their rulings a long time ago. And I think to reiterate how egregious that is,
yeah.
There is a piece of legislation in the House called H.R. 1, which won't pass the Senate. It could pass the House, but it has to do with requiring states to use a redistricting commission to make it nonpartisan.
Because this impacts both parties. In Maryland, it disenfranchises the Republicans. In North Carolina, it disenfranchises the Democrats. This is helpful and hurtful to both parties. Why would they want to not just level the playing field and play fairly?
Well, because to the victor go the spoils.
Yes, but sometimes
and
you don't
elections
win.
Matter, and elections that end in zero matter the most because that's when the census occurs,
and
that's when redistricting happens.
But back to the arguments in March, I think a lot of the conservative justices, they kept going back to this idea of proportional representation. And so North Carolina, of course, it's this purple state. We're close to 50-50, but the Democrats only have three seats. But then, and so to the plaintiffs, it looks very obvious that this is unfair. But the justices would go back to a place like Massachusetts, where 35% of the voters are Republican, maybe more. Mm-hmm. There will never be a Republican congressperson for Massachusetts because of the way they're distributed. They're just evenly spread out throughout the state, and it's very hard to draw a district that includes them.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, and some would argue here in North Carolina, it's the reverse, that Democrats are more concentrated in urban areas and Republicans are more fairly spread out. So even if you do have this magical wand of being able to draw fair maps, whatever fair is, it's still going to be some kind of inherent advantage.
Well, and that was one of the criteria. It said, how did 2018 play out? And that is rural versus urban areas. And That's probably not going to shift that much. It is difficult, especially if you throw in the independents, because I think they're about an equal number. I think the electorate in North Carolina is split on three ways.
It's getting a third, a third, a third.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we have, but we have a different makeup of the Supreme Court this time than the last time this was considered. Among them, Brett Kavanaugh, Justice Kavanaugh, conservative justice, and I can't think of the other conservative justice's name.
Gorsuch. Neil Gorsuch.
Are we clear where they might stand on this?
No.
Are they the wild cards here?
I would say Kavanaugh is probably more the wild card, but you've also got to throw in Chief Justice Roberts. And even though he was in the side of the conservatives to kind of say, this is really a political question, we don't need to get involved, he looks more long-term at the institution of the Supreme Court and sees the role of the court being the final arbiter in American law. And this could make or break the question of how partisan does the Supreme Court get in this regard.
So I think you said earlier that the court could decide on both of them.
Mm-hmm.
Either one of them,
mm-hmm.
neither of them.
Yes.
What's the likelihood of any of those?
I have studied redistricting. I wouldn't dare to venture a guess.
So let's talk about the process of how these decisions are handed down. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but sure. As I understand it, there are two boxes. What year is it?
Okay.
There are two boxes.
Could be three boxes.
Okay, where they drop. What?
Paper copies.
Paper copies of the decision in these analog boxes.
Yes. This is the Supreme Court of the United States.
Is this the wooden box that Charlotte sent to get to the Amazon bid? What are these boxes? What are they?
Okay. The boxes are merely the printed versions of the opinions. Nobody knows what is in the opinions until they are released.
And they hand down. Surely they have made.
They're posted on the website.
But they have made all these decisions already, right? They're not still deliberating on these,
well,
are they?
Well, they could be. I mean, they've still got, I think there's 12 cases still left before the end of this week to be decided.
So they may or may not have made a decision on this, is what you're saying.
There could be final tweaks going on.
And as they finish the tweaks, that's when they drop the final decision. So when will they drop the next couple of cases into the box?
So possibly in, 31 minutes, right? I mean,
No, not today. Wednesday is most likely, they announced on Monday that Wednesday would be an opinions release day, and likely Thursday as well. They've been releasing them 4 opinions a day. If they've got 12 or 8, you know, it's going to require at least a couple more days.
Michael, does the fact that it is late, it could be Wednesday or Thursday, does that give you a signal about which way the court is going to go?
Absolutely not. It's just, I mean, they hold oftentimes the most controversial and high-profile cases until the end.
Yeah.
So things like the gay marriage case, you know, was very late in the term when it was announced. This is just the way the court has always operated.
So if they punt on both of these cases, what happens then?
In my opinion, the attention in North Carolina turns to the state Supreme Court because there are state cases against the state legislative districts. And there you've got a 6-1 Democratic majority. And the likelihood is, like in Pennsylvania, the state Supreme Court will say, this is too much partisan gerrymandering. It violates the North Carolina Constitution's free election clause. And that's where you may get the real impact of it.
Okay. Let's move on to North Carolina. Legislators in the General Assembly have still not finalized the budget for next year. One of the things holding it up is the expansion of Medicaid. That's something Governor Roy Cooper wants, but which has been resisted by Republicans since the dawn of the Affordable Care Act. Neither the House nor the Senate versions of the budget contain Medicaid expansion proposals. So why the holdup? Because the governor will veto it without some kind of Medicaid expansion?
The likelihood is the governor will veto it, and the Republicans do not have supermajorities to override.
So if he vetoes the budget, they have to start the process over again or renegotiate?
Renegotiate.
Part of it? It is said that as negotiations between the legislature and the governor's office have continued, positions have hardened, not softened. What a surprise. So what does the governor want? What does he want this Medicaid expansion to be like?
Well, he basically the plan is if Medicaid is expanded in North Carolina, about 500,000 North Carolinians will then receive health insurance. And I think that this is, you know, the question is, do we want to give up 90% funding of that coverage from the federal government and the state chip in 10%? That's the ratio.
But that's been the deal since the very beginning.
Well, no, the very beginning was the federal government covered for the first 2 years 100%.
So that's sunsetted now?
And that has sunsetted, okay. And now the rate is 90-10.
So by waiting, we pay more.
Well, Republicans would contend that we don't know the numbers. We don't know how much of an impact this will be on the budget.
Why not? That's one of the arguments that Governor McCrory made in the face of the Affordable Care Act coming in. We don't want to expand Medicaid because our Medicaid system is already broken, and we can't get control of the cost, and we don't know what's going to cost going forward. Well, they've had 3 or 4 years now to figure it out.
And supposedly the Medicaid system is in better shape mm-hmm. in North Carolina right now. The question for Republicans is, you know, what do we do, you know, in terms of if the numbers do go up substantially? There are other states that have trigger provisions to say if your numbers exceed this, then that starts to ratchet down the amount of coverage that folks can get. So there's some states that have played with this in terms of a trigger provision that would take into account for that. But the Republicans are pretty much on fiscal issues.
So in states like North Carolina, where Republican legislatures have said no to the Medicaid component of the Affordable Care Act, there are a lot of people who fall through the cracks and can't get insurance. If we were to say yes to this proposal on Medicaid, and this was going to be in the budget going forward, that would end. They would be able to get insurance and fully take advantage of the Affordable Care Act?
The estimates are at least 500,000 North Carolinians would be able to have that. And there's also concerns about rural health care providers, hospitals in particular. They need some kind of support.
Why aren't they lobbying the legislatures here and around the country that don't do this?
I believe healthcare administrators are lobbying. And I mean, there's been reports from the Cone Foundation out of Winston, the North Carolina Health Association has put out positive feelers about this expansion, but it is a very political dynamic.
Mm. There are also still differences between the Senate and the House versions of the budget over things like teacher pay raises and raises for state employees. What do you know what those differences are and how they're likely to be ironed out?
One chamber gives a higher raise to teachers than the other.
Yeah, the House 4.6% beginning in January, the Senate 3.5% over 2 years, but it would begin July 1st of this year.
Right, and then state employees basically flipped as well. I think, you know, that will probably be hammered out between the chambers. The question ultimately becomes, when it's presented to the governor, what will he do?
Yeah.
And, you know, the budget is supposed to go into effect July 1st.
Right.
We will continue to have a budget. It will just simply be at the same level that it is currently, not new money.
So the state, unlike the federal government, doesn't shut down in the face of not having a budget. Any other major stumbling blocks in this budget between Democrats and Republicans, or between the legislature and the governor?
I think the biggest one is over school funding, school construction funding, bonds versus paying as you go kind of an approach, and that will probably get worked out between the two chambers as well.
It is said that a House and Senate compromise is likely, I think, next week. Would that be on the entire budget or only on the Medicaid portion of the budget?
It would probably be the entire budget, just simply because they have to agree to all the basic principles before it goes to the governor.
What kind of political support does the governor have on his Medicaid expansion, or the legislature, the Republicans in the legislature, have on their lack of desire to expand Medicaid? Is there any indication of how the people feel about this?
It's party politics. It's I remember seeing some poll in North Carolina that expansion of Medicaid was a majority did favor it. But this is purely party politics. I mean, it is Obamacare, so Republicans are going to throw up the red flags and say, no, never. For Democrats, it's part of their marching orders as well. So it's very intensely polarized through the partisan lenses.
Okay. Speaking of partisan politics in the legislature, imagine that. The state Senate voted yesterday on House Bill 370. They voted in favor of the legislation that could force North Carolina sheriffs from office if they don't carry out or don't cooperate, rather, with immigration officials, and that includes the 287G program, which our sheriff here, Gary McFadden, and I think two or three other urban area sheriffs in the state ended when they came into office after the November election. It passed the Senate. Will the governor sign it? It has to go back to the House now for whatever reason.
Right.
And it will pass in the House, no question, right?
Yeah.
The governor said, I think he said yesterday, he feels like it's unconstitutional. Okay. Did not say specifically he'll veto, but I think reading between the lines, there'll be a veto and probably not enough votes to override. So 370 is a definite, elections have consequences. Mm-hmm. No more supermajority.
Right. So yesterday, the Senate vote was 25-18 along a party line and then has to head back to the House. Why? It already passed the House. Why does it have to go back to the House? I don't understand
process. I think there were some amendments made in the Senate that the House has to concur to. So the bills have to be identical.
And the people who support House Bill 370 say, and they say it protects the people of North Carolina because it keeps dangerous immigrants, their words, off the street. Whereas the sheriffs in these areas, and including our own police chief, Kerr Putney, say cooperation with 287G makes us less safe because it makes people less willing to come forward and cooperate with police in investigations. Do we have any empirical evidence that either is true?
I've
never seen any.
Wow. Okay. So what's the rationale for this bill? Is it purely politics? Is it purely that we have a Trump administration who is trying to get a handle on people coming across the border and 287G gets people who have been arrested off the streets and sent back? Or is this because they really believe this is endangering us as citizens of North Carolina and we must get a handle on it?
Yes to all of the above. I think that looking in line with, and Donald Trump has done such a good job, if you want, good with in parentheses, of messaging and creating the narrative of dangerous immigrants and hordes of individuals flooding our border, flooding our cities. So I think that's it's a very good narrative, and he's done a very good job. And it's a partisan issue.
And it's about framing the issue.
Yeah.
And how you frame it, considerably the abortion debate that we've had just a few weeks ago, it's the same thing. It's all about base party politics.
So we'll come back and talk more about that and about the District 9 race and also about the presidential debates that start, tomorrow, I think? Mm-hmm. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Steve Harrison is with us from WFAE News. Dr. Susan Roberts, political science professor at Davidson College, and Dr. Michael Bitzer, professor of politics and history at Catawba College, all here talking about summer politics, of which there is much. Under House Bill 370, which passed the Senate yesterday here in North Carolina, which now goes back to the House and then will go to the governor for his signature or his veto. Under this bill, sheriffs who do not comply with ICE requests to cooperate with the 287G program, and that is the program, as I understand it, where if you arrest somebody, you ask them about their citizenship mm-hmm. status, and if they are not citizens, you report that to ICE, and ICE will come and get them at some point. And some sheriffs are also not cooperating in other ways with ICE, with these detainer requests. They're just not doing it. Under this bill, if signed, the sheriffs who don't comply could lose their jobs. Now, these people are duly elected officials. Is that legal? Is that constitutional to remove somebody from office? But then there are also law enforcement officers who are allegedly not enforcing the law.
Yes. In the state constitution, the provision on sheriffs does define that sheriffs can be removed for violations of the law.
But this is a federal law. Would this make it the passage of this House bill make it a state law?
It would make it a state law.
Okay. So what do you think will happen? Will they stick to their guns and be removed or
cooperate? I think if, as Steve indicated, I think the governor will veto this particular law. I mean, remember, he was attorney general. He was the chief law enforcement officer before he became governor. And I think he'll veto it. The override will
fail. He calls
it
unconstitutional. On what grounds?
I don't know specifically what he was referencing, but I think the bill will die.
Really?
Due to lack of override.
Okay. Well, the 9th Congressional District has been having an election for a decade now. and that continues. And the actual election day will be in an unusual time of year. It will be in September. But it's been relatively quiet since they've chosen the two Dans, Dan Bishop, the Republican, and Dan McCready, the Democrat. There have been some back and forth, but quiet. Is that unusual?
I think it's hard to break through in the summertime.
Yeah.
Everyone's busy. Everyone's got things going on. And it's hard to break through when it's the only election that's being, you know, I mean, so much of these congressional races, we get swept up in the excitement of who's going to control the House. And in terms of that bigger picture, this is pretty inconsequential because it's going to add what the Democratic pickup would go from 40
to 41.
41. So I think
For a moment in time, because the next election is coming up
really quickly. And I think the race has been interesting. I think both sides are. You know, in the previous McCready-Mark Harris race, it was kind of the same theme over and over again. Mark Harris just said, you're going to vote for Nancy Pelosi for speaker. Dan McCready then turned around and said, you're too conservative. You're going to be aligned with Mark Meadows. That was really the extent of it. And there's been a little more back and forth about some issues this time. But like you said, we're all thinking about the beach.
One of the issues is something that Dan Bishop brought up and accused Dan McCready of, and that is receiving dark money. First of all, what is dark money?
Well, and let me say one thing, too. I think there's just 9th District fatigue. I mean, everybody, it was so riveting for a while, and then it's kind of, people say, well, it's resolved itself. But the reports did say receiving dark money.
What is dark money?
Dark money is generally just money from a nonpartisan, a nonprofit that doesn't have to be disclosed. And it sounds, I guess, worse than it is, but it's on both sides of the aisle.
Okay.
And it really is benefiting from the dark money. And the group that Bishop cited, the Patriot Majority PAC, and this is why it's, you know, it's kind of funny, but their goal is to protect American freedom, resist authoritarianism, jobs and economic opportunity, and restoring the American dream. Who can't be for that? And so I think that.
But these, is it a PAC?
Yeah, I mean,
okay.
That.
So these PACs are you can donate to PACs, and you're not donating to the candidate, and the PAC can put out commercial advertising
against
the other person or in favor
or
of the candidate they support, but that money does not go to the candidate.
No.
And they can't endorse a candidate. They can just take up issues for or against that the candidate would support or not. Correct?
Well, yes.
So he didn't receive the money.
He didn't receive
the money. He benefited from the advertising.
He benefited. And there's, you know,
What's wrong with that?
Well, a lot of people think that it's excessive. It increases the negativity.
But the candidate can't control that.
Well,
allegedly, there can be no contact between the candidate and these PACs, right?
Yes, but people have tried to make that stick and tried to look into it, but they can't do it as well as you would think. And when you look at the Patriot Majority and look at their website, they give examples of the ads. And the Harris ad is one of those ads that they kind of tout as, here's what we can do for you. The beauty of that ad, that they can it for anywhere, is it's about around these parts, and that's part of the dialogue, around these parts. You know, Mark Harris wants to cut Medicaid and Social Security and benefit the wealthy. And, you know, it's real folksy.
Yeah.
And when you look at it, it could be, you could say, insert Mark Harris' name here.
Right. Mosey on down to the voting booth and pull that lever.
In these neck of the woods.
Given the closeness of the race between Dan McCready and Mark Harris, I think it was 905 votes that Harris won that election, which was then called into question and overturned. How likely are we to see similar results this time between the two Dans?
I guess just my question as I look at the race is, this is a Republican seat that Trump won handily, and you had a blue wave year that got Dan McCready close with the 905 votes.
And that environment is not
with
us. It's
just not there.
So, why not? Why aren't Democrats itching to push him over the top? Why aren't Republicans out for revenge and want this seat because they got it last time and it was taken away from them? Why isn't there more interest, excitement, tension in this?
Among the true believers, there on both sides, there will be that. For everybody else, this is one race in the middle of September that nobody else really cares about. And so I think the dynamics just tend to level back to the pre-2018 Democratic blue wave. And
so that would explain why maybe Dan Bishop, the Republican, would not be out there doing a heck of a lot, because he's liable to win by doing nothing.
Well, but
what about Dan
early.
McCready?
It's still early.
How early? It's, what, 3 months?
Well, I think it still comes down, as it seems so trite, to turnout. Who can turn out the people for this race that no one's paying attention to? And I want to interject just one thing about Bishop's charges. You know, I don't like to use the term OPPO research, but opposition research.
It's called OPPO
Bishop,
research.
Yes,
you see.
Oh, yes.
OPPO research. We know that.
What he did, Bishop's staff, in finding this out, is a legitimate example of researching your opponent and finding something, and in this case, that would show, or at least try to show, that McCready is hypocritical.
And last week, let's go back to 2018. Democrats across the country ran on health care, laser-focused on health care. And so last week, McCready held a news conference at a pharmacy in Matthews. He unveiled his plan to lower the cost of prescription drugs. So he's going back to that playbook. And during that news conference, he criticized Bishop for a vote 2 years ago in the General Assembly. There was some legislation that would make it easier for doctors to prescribe, make it easier to use generic drugs. Mm. Dan Bishop was the only senator to vote against it. So it was a great attack.
Right.
But then when you kind of look back at it closely, Bishop supported it. He had voted for similar legislation. The bill had been changed. He said it came to him on the floor. And he says, as a matter of principle, he had like 5 minutes to read it. He says, as a matter of principle, I won't vote for something I haven't read. And voted no, and it passed.
But then he's the architect of HB2, and I know that Dan Bishop says that's old news. People want to move on from that. But why aren't Democrats just hammering away at that? Because that's what he would take to Washington, that sensibility.
I think that you will see that probably in the ads coming in August. That'll start flooding the airwaves.
Okay.
You know, that will be a likely Democratic attack line.
Speaking of Democrats and Republicans, the Democratic debates begin this week, tomorrow night, and continue Thursday. Two consecutive nights, 4 hours, 10 candidates each night, which I think leave some of the candidates on the floor. They don't get the debate.
And there are 12 of them. So
okay.
many opportunities.
What role will this debate in the next two nights play in cutting away at the field?
I think it'll be very important, because I think political scientists have talked about this quote-unquote invisible primary.
Because I've never heard of some of these people.
No, and I wrote a list in case you ask me. I have all the names. And I think I could fudge what some of the people are, who they are. But it's you try to get name recognition, money, and get an organization. And I think with the criteria that the Democrats have put on in terms of polling numbers and fundraising, it is fairly unique. And their early numbers, polling numbers, don't usually matter, but people have squeaked out the polling numbers.
So the party has decided, not NBC, the party has decided who gets the debate. Have they also decided who participates on tomorrow's debate versus Thursday's debate?
It
was kind of curious system in which they kind of divided up what they considered to be the top tier candidates versus the lesser known candidates. And I think that night two will be more interesting, because there'll be comparison with night one, and they'll be anticipating. So they'll be reflecting and also projecting for night two.
So Time Magazine says Senator Elizabeth Warren will have a plan for that. Former Representative Beto O'Rourke will have to make his case without jumping on a table. And Senator Cory Booker will seek to reclaim his mantle as America's favorite Rhodes Scholar turned mayor. Okay, so what will candidates like Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, and Pete Buttigieg have to do or not do?
Well, I think they need to establish some of the Bernie Sanders, the Joe Bidens do not need to establish their name. But there are a lot of dynamics going into this. One that I think is going to be fascinating for me is, even though his advisors say don't, Trump has played with the idea of tweeting, live tweeting during the debates, which, you know, I can't, that's kind of split screen
television. But they're on NBC, not Fox. How will he see them?
I don't know, but I'm well. He'll find a way. But I think that that's one of the reasons that these are again so unusual. Mm-hmm. And the Democrats with 12, and the Republicans had 9. But interestingly enough, and I just looked this up for comparison for who's watching. And as Steve said, it's summer; people aren't paying attention. But the first Republican debate was the largest in history.
Who chose the network?
I think the Democratic Party.
Mayor Pete Buttigieg had to go home to face voters in South Bend over the weekend after a police shooting in that city. What happened at that town hall meeting in between the mayor and some constituents in a various different outdoor settings did not have the kind of optics that a presidential candidate yearns for. Will he be hurt, or will voters think he comported himself well in a difficult situation?
I think that's the lens in which you see it. I think that it was a smart decision to go home, the only decision he had. But I can't believe this helps him in any way because it's still evolving. And he's taking, you know, a little, not a wait and see approach, but he's, you know, he's taking the approach. It's not immediate action. And that's what a lot of people want.
I mean, we're far away from 2020 and the election, but there are a lot of people who are unknown in these debates coming up over the next two nights. Among them, although you know his name probably, HUD Secretary Julian Castro. You have Maryland Representative John Delaney, Colorado Senator Michael Bennett, entrepreneur Andrew Yang,
who?
And others. Do any of them have a chance at all? Or is this just an exercise in becoming more well-known?
I don't think any of them have a chance because you have to, and my colleagues may disagree, but I think there's, you know, the whole question of even though you may not think it's going to change from day to day, from month to month, it still gets down to, for the Democrats, the same kind of calculus that Nancy Pelosi is using in terms of impeachment, of electability. Who can beat Donald Trump?
The Democrats have to pick a candidate who can beat Donald Trump. They also have to come up with a coherent message that resonates with voters, their base, and others. So does a field this large, this early in the game, help or hurt that?
Well, and I think it hurts in a way. Who is the audience they're speaking to? Is it a demographic? Will these be millennials, progressives? How are they crafting their argument? Mike, what?
Yeah, I think the big question in my mind is who has a punch-out moment? I mean, of those lesser-tier candidates, you know, the Bidens, the Sanders, the Warrens, the Kamala Harrises, they all have the name recognition and possibility. Who punches up to get a moment out of the debate that then propels them into maybe tier two, not tier one?
In addition to the score of candidates that'll be on the dais the next two nights, we have 5 moderators because NBC is showcasing all of their talent from Lester Holt to Rachel Maddow. Doesn't that get in the way too, having all these moderators?
Well, I would think so. It seems quite busy. People can remember Megyn Kelly as a moderator and the kind of questions that she crafted. I don't know how you're going to remember the messages from or the questions from all these individuals.
So what are you looking for in these debates?
Well, I think I'm looking for the degree to which they'll go for personality versus policy. Beto O'Rourke is now supposedly prepping with more policy teams because people were saying, you know, he was the flash.
Mm-hmm. So the debates will be on tomorrow night and Thursday night on NBC, on the NBC television network, which is what you can get on by turning 36, and also on MSNBC and on Telemundo. I guess they'll also be having translation on Telemundo as well. Susan Roberts from Davidson College, Michael Bitzer from Catawba College, Steve Harrison from WFAE News. Thank you all. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.